Natural Living with Gary Null, exploring the nature and politics of medicine, health, nutrition, and the environment. And now your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I am Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to the program. Today, we'll be continuing with our ongoing series of exploring all the different health and nutrition issues that affect so many people in this audience. I'll be giving you a wide variety of topics, ones that have generally not been given a lot of attention, or where they have, where we would have to challenge how objective their insights have been. I'm also going to definitely be taking calls today, and our number for those in just the tri-state area is 212-209-2900. Please keep in mind that you can hear this program free of charge, 24 hours a day, anywhere in the world. If you go to GaryNull.com, you'll see the instructions of how you can get that information. So we do have that service now available, and it's a public service. I'm not in New York. I'm out of the city, and will be for a period of time doing what I hope will make a difference in some of the issues involving public health. Let's go to the issues. First up, a lot of parents have been caught in a predicament. They find that there's something wrong with their child. In an effort to try to resuscitate the child and get the child back to a state of, let's say if the child is not breathing, they shake the child. Well, many times when that child ends up dying, frequently from something that would be called sudden infant death syndrome, the autopsy shows that it looks like the child has been abused. And as a result, parents are frequently charged with the death of their child. The parents plead that they have not done anything to harm the child, that they were merely trying to resuscitate the child. Unfortunately, up to this point, they have not been given any benefit of a doubt. And almost universally, they have been found guilty and then sentenced to the different verdicts that the court allows. Here, however, is a different perspective on it, because this is the latest study, and this study, which was just published in a major peer-reviewed journal, shows that there could be a reason for that. I'll quote it verbatim. This is from the Daily Telegraph, from Robert Ulig, technology correspondent. Study casts doubt on shaken baby death cases. Even very gentle shaking could kill a baby, according to the largest and most detailed study ever done on the brains of infants who died in suspicious circumstances. The British study found that rough handling could be sufficient to damage nerve fibers in the neck area that control breathing, leading to brain swelling, characteristic of violent shaking. The research published in The New Scientist challenges the widely held view that only extremely violent violence causes shaken baby syndrome, and calls into question the scientific evidence behind many convictions for killing infants. It could open the way for a wave of appeals. And so here's the basis of it. Innocent people trying to revive their infants then end up in prison. Think of that. Think of the damage done both to the psyche and spirit of the person who had the crisis of a baby dying in the first place and then being convicted of killing the baby when they didn't. And this is showing for the first time just even gently shaking a baby is enough to kill them. So I'm glad that that information is in, because even people have taken a polygraph test and show that they never did anything against their baby, those polygraph tests were still not admitted. This comes from Reuters. United Kingdom scientists conducted HK baby nuclear tests from Hong Kong. British scientists listed specific body parts of dead Hong Kong children they needed for nuclear experiments between the 1950s and mid-70s, the South China Morning Post reported. Citing official British records, the newspaper said some Hong Kong medical officials had given approval for bodies of Hong Kong children to be used in the tests without parental consent. Pressure has been mounting on the Hong Kong government for a probe into the recent reports in British newspapers that 6,000 stillborn children and babies were sent from Australia, Britain, Canada, Hong Kong, the United States, and South America over a 15-year period. The bodies and body parts were used by the U.S. Department of Energy for tests to monitor the impact of fallout and radioactivity from nuclear tests. The remains of Hong Kong babies were also used by British scientists for similar tests and research that ended in the mid-70s. So they were using dead babies in their nuclear experiments without telling anyone, including the parents. This comes from Dr. John Breeding. Now, for those of you who had listened to the series I did on abuses in psychiatry, Dr. Breeding was one of the guests that I had in that series and also had quoted him. And this is an open letter to President Bush on federal psychiatric drug experimentation on young children. And I'll quote it. He said, "Evaluation and research," and Dr. Diana Murphy, Associate Director of Pediatrics in the Food and Drug Administration, has responded to criticism of the government's initiative. That is, by the way, just to put it into perspective, the FDA and the National Institutes of Mental Health want to target 3 to 5-year-old children for psychiatric drug experiments that are neither medically justified nor without risk. And these officials are defending the preschool ADHD treatment study and other federally funded psychiatric drug research on children. Dr. Temple Murphy from the FDA clearly represent the Psychiatric Pharmaceutical Government Industrial Alliance when they state, quote, "We do not think failure to study widespread uses that many experts believe may be useful in the interest of pediatric patients," unquote. Is this the clear thesis? And we respond as antithesis. Now, before I quote him direct now, keep in mind, let's put it in perspective. It began with, it began in the 1950s and just became really accelerated by the mid-70s, where we were looking at youth as being diseased. At that point, it was a relatively small percentage and primarily of what was considered schizophrenia in youth that had been inherited from their adults. Well, I don't believe that there is any such thing as a true schizophrenia, and therefore there wouldn't be anything as passing it on genetically. But that was immaterial to all the scientists who were getting an enormous amount of funding to prove this, of course, which they've never proven. Now, starting in the mid-90s, there was an enormous effort under the Clinton White House and his health care plan to start focusing upon the children. And especially since they already had the market cornered in the pharmaceutical industry that was really behind all this, had pretty much maxed their capacity for teenagers, they wanted to get younger kids. And the way you get younger kids is you go through mandatory screening programs. You start with inner city, and then you expand from there. And you try to show that you were looking for the gene, or we're looking for behavior that can predict an outcome. And, of course, there is no such thing. But, again, that's really irrelevant. Truth, facts has never been relevant in any of these issues. Behind the scenes is over 400 pharmaceutical company and insurance agencies and people who had given greatly to the various campaigns. And they gave both sides. It's really immaterial. They gave to Republicans and Democrats, and they had a lot of say-so. So then Hillary comes forward and says, you know, that we want a village to raise your children. And anything that we tell you is clearly in the need of the child and the parent. So we all get behind this initiative to try to stamp out mental illness and stamp out the diseases that affect children, stamp out the genetic predisposition to violence. Of course, once again, we're all blaming the children, and that the drugs will make it all better, and the treatment is only really beneficial if we catch it in time. Once again, put time on your side. The last time I heard that slogan was with AZT. Wonder what happened to all those people who tried to put time on their side with AZT. Of course, again, truth and facts are really irrelevant. It's not paying attention to what was occurring. So that brings us up to now the National Institutes of Mental Health, a virtually worthless organization that has no purpose whatsoever. It's like the International or the Interstate Commerce Commission. Again, no purpose. Except this time, it provides enormous amounts of grants to psychiatrists and others to study the so-called impact of mental illness. So here is his response, that we need to be testing these 3 to 5 year olds for mental illness. We know that giving psychiatric drugs to children is evil because it harms young lives. How do we know this? First and foremost, we know that the inherent nature of children is that they are good, intelligent, zestful, and inclined toward warm and affectionate relationships. Given the absence of truly organic damage caused by direct physical trauma or missing parts due to birth defects, which are exceedingly rare, and given proper care and attention, this is what we see of children. Second, we know that psychiatric drugs are dangerous and toxic. This is readily verified for any known psychotropic drug. Most definitely for those commonly used on children, such as the stimulant drugs and the so-called antidepressants. Third, we know that no problem routinely diagnosed as psychiatric has been proven to be of biological or genetic origin. There are no verifiable markers, no identified confirmatory physical and chemical abnormalities for any childhood psychiatric diagnosis. This alone is sufficient to qualify any psychiatric drug experimentation with children as wholly unethical. Fourth, we know a great deal about the causes of childhood distress and school failure. Regarding the latter, we know, for example, that the majority of behavior problems in school can be attributed to failures in learning to read, usually due to improper teaching methods. It has been demonstrated that remediation of reading failure takes care of many of the special needs of these children. And we also know that many children are sleep deprived, that a great many view hours of electronic media every day, that the average child's diet is in this country is nutritionally abysmal, and that all these factors can and do result in behavior which psychiatry classifies as a disease. Fifth, we also know that physical and emotional hurt or neglect causes emotional distress, and that accumulation of this distress results in tense, withdrawn, unkind, or unfocused behavior in children. Further, we know that giving children very good attention and encouragement to express these pent-up emotions consistently results in improvement in mood and behavior and restoration of their natural qualities of zest and aliveness, intelligence, and affinity for others. Hence, psychiatric drugs are not only dangerous, they are absolutely unnecessary. Attention and research on genetic and biological interpretation of children's lives and subsequent use of drugs can only harm and suppress children. It also has the consistent effect of allowing adults to avoid these critical primary responsibilities, which is to offer children environmental care which truly meets their needs. When millions of children are suffering grievously, it is not, as psychiatry attests, an indicator of an epidemic of defective genetics and biology. Rather, it is a moral failure on the part of society's adults to do what it takes to understand and truly meet the children's needs. No more drug experiments on our precious children. We know that giving psychiatric drugs to children is evil because it harms young lives. We know that the inherent nature of children is completely good, highly intelligent, zestful, and loving to be close and affectionate. We know a lot about how to ensure that this nature is not covered up by the distressing effects of various hurts and neglects. And we know how to help them restore their glorious inherent nature when this happens. I implore you to do the right thing and call for a halt to this cruel and unnecessary experimentation on our precious children. Sincerely, John Breeding, PhD, Director, Texans for Safe Education. Let me add something to that. The reason that I mentioned Hillary Clinton, because it was she and she as the front person who has done more to implement the idea that our children need these drugs, and along with Tipper Gore, they paraded out all these psychiatrists and behavioralists from the National Institute of Mental Health who all had pharmaceutical ties, to state these great programs are going into the inner city. They're the ones who help continue the proliferation of community mental health centers, which were really places to be for the inner city children to be given medications, which can create violence and have. Now, they have never taken the time, except for photo shoot ops, as if there's nothing real in their life. Everything's just one constant, controlled PR campaign. There's never a moment where these people are just real. And they're the ones responsible. So we have to focus on who's responsible. And unfortunately, in this context, I'm asking, what happened to the liberal press? What happened to The Nation and other publications? What happened to all these people who, rightly so, have found condemnation in so many of the egregious acts of multinational corporate interest? And yet, if someone calls themselves a New Deal Democrat or a progressive Democrat, their actions on these issues are simply supported and not challenged or denied completely. We are creating an entire generation of stigmatized youth. We are not giving these kids the type of the unconditional love and attention they deserve. The fact that the baby boomer is able to work hard enough to support all the different classes and tutors and special education and private schools is no substitute for quality parenting. And all they have to do is look around at the results. Historically, we thought that it was only the poor, inner-city, African-American and Latino culture that suffered the consequences to the youth when there was this deprivation. That was unfortunately an over-general stigmatization of an entire culture. It is another form of racism. In point of fact, I went with Dr. Janice Keller Phelps and watched who came in to the courtrooms in Maryland, Chevy Chase, Alexandria, and around the District of Columbia in the suburbs. Almost all affluent, almost all related to the government bureaucracies or the foundations and lobbyists, and all white, upper mobile families, kids. Kids who've committed crimes, it just didn't make the newspapers. Kids who were given all forms of relief, where other kids of color would have been put in jail and stigmatized. If a kid of color makes that same mistake of stealing a car, vandalizing, then, or using drugs, is considered a genetic or inherent defect. If a white does it, it's considered, well, they're just wild kids, but they're going through it and they'll grow out of it, and everybody pays for it and it's hushed up. Double standards. Now, these parents should take a moment and step back and say, what has really been the ingredients necessary to create what has occurred with our children? You go into any of those suburbs and ask how many of those kids are on Ritalin or Prozac, you would be dumbfounded at the high percentage. So, does it mean that a drug is just an addition to our extended family care? The drug is a nanny. The Ritalin is a father to enforce a certain emotional stability or conformity. It's a dangerous precedent. And I would hope that we stop long enough and see that groups have been very selective in their political ideologies in how they will attack issues that have political merit and media attention, and others that don't go near, that deserve the same focus and attention. As it is right now, both sides, Republican and Democrat, are equal. They're both controlled by the pharmaceutical interest, the largest single contributors to the campaign. Let's go on to Patrick Bishop in Paris. A headline: France stunned as chef rejects the pleasures of flesh. For the French, it is the equivalent of a pacifist general or an atheist cardinal. Alain Passard, president genius of the Michelin three-star El Arpège restaurant in Paris, has gone vegetarian. Beef, lamb, chicken, veal, all staples of the special cuisine in their repertoire have been struck from the menu of this Left Bank establishment. The dishes will now be based on vegetables, and not necessarily fancy ones, but carrots, turnips, celery, onions, leeks, from a market garden in western France. His decision has stunned a nation of dedicated carnivores, albeit rather chastened ones as a result of recent food health scares. He has said, quote, this has got nothing to do with mad cow disease. It's got nothing to do with morality. It's just that I woke up one morning and I didn't take any pleasure anymore in eating meat. I wanted to change the material with which I work. It's like an artist who works in watercolors and turns his hand to oils or to sculpture in wood or changes to bronze, unquote. Last week, the menu featured celery and chestnuts on a truffle fondue, parsnips, black radishes, cabbage and thistle with parmesan and black truffles, mousse of avocado and pistachio oil on a shaft of caviar. He says, I feel much more comfortable producing a dish using a carrot or a radish, whereas I had no emotion for a rump steak or a saddle of lamb. Some Paris chefs have banned beef since the mad cow scandal. In fact, Alain Dussault dropped it from the menu of what was to be a new beef and lobster bar. And the Grand Before has not served it in several years. Well, good news. I'm glad to see that happen. Just a few thoughts on that. When I was in Paris last, I went to that particular restaurant. In fact, I like to go to different restaurants to see the cuisine. And what I really appreciate about French cuisine is not the creams and so much dairy put on things. I really respect the brilliance of the originality of their dishes and their presentation. All over the world, I travel and I look at cuisines. In fact, I wrote an international cookbook, if many of you remember, and possibly even have, the International Vegetarian Cuisine Cookbook. And when I sit there and I'll look at a dish, and I'll see, how's it presented? How do they mix the different ingredients? And you can actually smell a dish and frequently know how it's going to taste. And how does it set up on a plate? And when I was in Paris last, we went to this one restaurant that had almost nothing on the menu that I could actually eat. I could appreciate how it would look and get ideas because I love to see ideas. But when I told the waiter there was really nothing there that didn't have dairy, and he said, well, what would you like? We'll make it for you. I said, well, I'm a vegetarian, a vegan. He said, fine. Came back about 35 minutes later with what was quite simply the finest looking vegetarian dish I've ever seen in my life. They did a crown of vegetables, meaning they started at the bottom and they put in different miniature carrots and miniature broccoli and they kept wrapping it around this plate in circles so that by the time, and elevated, so it was like a foot high, and there must have been 35 different vegetables, and then they put different sauces, non-dairy sauces, non-egg sauces, and they had five different sauces. There was five layers. There was a different sauce for each layer, rolled over the vegetables, and then they put edible flowers in. And I just looked at this. I said, this is just wonderful. So, I took my camera out and I took a picture of it. And I went into the kitchen and they charged me an astronomical $12. $12 for this whole thing. And I went in the kitchen. I thanked the chef and congratulated him on. He said, oh, it was nothing. It was just, you know, very quick. He said, I'm sorry I didn't take my time. If I had really taken my time, I'd have done a better job, but done something more interesting. And I thought then, I said, you realize that there are a lot of people like me, and possibly your regular customers, that if you had a dish like this on the menu, they would buy it. They would use it. And he smiled and said, well, we occasionally get a request. He said, but there are a lot of French restaurants that specialize in this. I didn't know that. And then I spent time going around to the ones that he had mentioned, and sure enough, they had like 30 different dishes like that. And I thought, whoa. Now, I thought there was a time when I had what was considered the finest gourmet vegetarian restaurant in the United States, and I had that for 7 years, the Fertile Earth. And then later Gary's Place, and then finally this last one. But my time commitments have simply taken me away from there. And I thought, there is the value, before opening a restaurant, of going to other countries to see what they've done. And so I really appreciate. So if you're ever in France, go there. And actually go to the markets early in the morning. Like our farmers market, they have farmers markets that are like 5 blocks long. It's almost the size of the one in Dallas. Largest farmers market in America is down in Dallas. It's at the bottom end of Dallas, and I used to go there almost every week when I had my ranch, the Healing Springs Ranch, and pick up all the organic produce. You might have 600 different stalls of people to buy stuff from. It was the size of 6 football fields, all 24 hours. It was 7 days a week, 365 days a year it was open. And most of it was actually organic from small little farmers. And so you can't always appreciate what you have until you see something else that someone else has. Then it gives you a little perspective. And the chefs in France pride themselves in going out in the morning and buying all their stuff fresh and being very selective and very critical about what goes into their kitchen and what goes on a plate. And just wonderful. Anyhow, so I'm very happy to see that one of the most famous chefs in French restaurants is now strictly vegetarian. And I'm sure that there will be more to follow. This comes from Mike Cooper from Reuters, Atlanta. The U.S. government on Thursday added a new vaccine against the disease that causes meningitis and bloodstream infections to the list of shots that infants should receive before the age of 2. A new childhood immunization schedule issued by the Center for Disease Control and Prevention recommended 4 doses of the new pneumococcal conjugate vaccine for infants aged 23 months and younger to combat the disease. Quote, the vaccine would be given at the same visit where children receive the other vaccines on immunization schedule, said the National Immunization Program CDC's director. I disagree with this. I think this is disastrous. I would never allow my child to be vaccinated with this. If you look at the history of how many people actually get meningitis, and which is an infection of the brain and spinal cord, and how many people get bloodstream infections every year among children that age, and then compare it to how many people that they're going to vaccinate, and the dangers of the vaccine, and there's never been a test done on this to determine that it will actually work. And this is the White Theris Laboratories, which is a division of American Home Products, and they're in the vaccine business. And look at all the other disasters they've given us. So just a heads up, before you go out and get this vaccine, ask these questions of your pediatrician. 1, show me the proof that if you vaccinate my child, the child is immunized and will not get meningitis or this bloodstream infection. 2, give me a guarantee that it won't happen in writing. So if it does, I could sue you. 3, give me all the scientific studies showing that this has been tested to prove both safety and efficacy. 4, give me the statistics to show me how many patients you see in my child's age group each year, 3 to 5, who have meningitis or bloodstream infections. And last, show me the information of what they did to create a sterile environment for the vaccine to be produced. What is actually in the vaccine considered inert ingredients? Then let's see to what degree your pediatrician has done their homework. If you want information on what's in these vaccines, go to GaryNull.com under vaccination. The number to call in if you'd like to join us in this forum is 212-209-2900. And we're going to go to the calls now and say hello and see who's on the line and see what the issues are and how I might be able to help you. Hi, what's your name, please? You're on the air. You just have to speak up so I can hear you.
Oh, peace, Gary. How are you?
Good.
I'm calling to see if I can get some natural help from my mother. She's about 72, and because of many small vascular accidents, she's losing memory function and acting a bit like she has Alzheimer's. What are the natural supplements that I can help her with?
Describe some of the symptoms that your mother has, please.
General confusion, wearing two hats, going out with three pocketbooks, losing keys all the time. She just sometimes is not able to find words for what she wants. You know, she has.
What's her age?
She's 72.
Okay. Let's go on a little journey now, all right?
Mm-hmm.
Got a pencil and paper?
Right in my hand.
Good. First, understand that Alzheimer's is a progression. It didn't start in a vacuum. It just doesn't happen one day when you hit a certain age. It is the accumulation of toxins in the body, and generally a lot of those toxins are heavy metal toxins. Lead, cadmium, mercury are at the top of the list of things that I would try to focus attention on. And by the way, there is a medical doctor who came into New York yesterday, and we filmed him. He's an MD, PhD, and chiropractor. He covered all bases. He's a remarkable person. And he is at the end stage of Parkinson's. And he has tried everything orthodox medicine could offer, and without any success, and with some devastating side effects. And he emailed me and presented his story, and so asked, would there be anything else, because there's nothing else that he could do. And very shortly, he'll be completely incapable of doing anything for himself. So he flew into New York, and we picked him up at the airport, and we're taking care of him. He's indigent also. He's virtually broke. And so we're, you know, taking care of his rent, and all of his medical treatment is being paid for by myself. And the reason that we're doing all this, aside from the fact that every human being deserves to be helped, is because he is an MD, PhD, and chiropractor, and a professor, and educator, and a clinician. If there's anything we can do that can measurably change the progression of this condition or reverse any of the symptoms, then he has said and put it in writing that he will go out there and advocate a refocus of the medical model on how we deal with Parkinson's. And maybe that will make a difference for all the other people who are going to be suffering the debilitation of Parkinson's, who have no hope except the orthodox model, which has failed miserably. So I believe it's more than worth it for him as a human being on a spiritual level to help, but also what he then could do in being another person. We need as many voices as possible advocating constructive realignment of our protocols. We're just using all the wrong protocols. That said, you could have more people with Alzheimer's line up for that kind of help as with Parkinson's. And Alzheimer's is simply another form of dementia, meaning you simply decline in intellectual function. There are probably, right now, I'm going to guess, minimum 5 million, as high as probably 10 million, because a lot of them are simply not diagnosed. A lot of people just keep people at home and don't get them into a position of actually being diagnosed. Put it another way, you've got almost 10% of all Americans over the age of 65, and as many as 50% of those over 85. And dementia is the fourth leading cause of death in those over 60. And Alzheimer's kills about 100,000 people per year, so we're talking about a deadly disease. Put it another way, it's five times more likely to kill an American this year than AIDS. And yet you almost hear nothing about it.
From accidents caused?
And it can strike people really in their 40s. That's why you have to pay attention to it earlier. And the disorder was first identified in 1907 by a German neurologist named Alois Alzheimer, and that hence the name Alzheimer's. And it was characterized by progressive mental deterioration, where you do exactly what your mother's doing, wearing three hats and forgetting keys and all these other symptoms. But it can also go beyond that. You can end up with depression. You have no capacity for putting space and time together. You really don't know where you're at. You can't concentrate. You can't even communicate because you can't concentrate. Incontinence, losing bowel and bladder control,
yeah.
Personality changes, and some really drastic mood changes. Generally, once a person's been diagnosed, they'll live 4 to 10 years. And we always used to think, not we, but the medical community thought that it was a psychological phenomenon. When, point of fact, it's not. It really has nothing to do with the psyche. It has everything to do with the body, and especially the changes in the brain that then cause a psychic manifestation. The nerve fibers surrounding the hippocampus, the brain's memory center, become tangled, and information is no longer carried properly to and from the brain. So new memories cannot be formed, and memories formed earlier cannot be retrieved. And then you end up with plaques. And those plaques, the same plaques that will accumulate in your arteries, leading to atherosclerosis, accumulate in the brain. And the plaques are made up of a protein substance called beta amyloid. And these plaques damage nerve cells. So when you have enough plaque in the brain and this amyloid damage in the brain, then you end up with what is known as dementia. And it's progressive as it gets harder. The arteries, the veins feeding into the brain, it cuts down the supply of the blood to the brain. The death of the brain tissue can happen from a minor stroke, from pressure exerted by accumulation in the brain, and all that is going to be happening. It's just, it happens across the board. It's just that each person has it happen in different ways. There is definitely, irrespective of what the industry would like us to believe, there is an aluminum connection. In fact, autopsies performed on persons who have died of Alzheimer's show that they have a 400% more aluminum in the nerve cells of the brain. And especially high concentrations of aluminum are found in the hippocampus area, which is crucial to memory. In fact, you could go clear back about 11, 12 years to The Lancet, and they reported on a higher concentration of aluminum in the drinking water. We're exposed to antacids, antidiuremic, buffered aspirin. What do you think they buffer the aspirin with? When you have, let's say, 15 milligrams, aspirin is buffered with aluminum, one of two compounds, aluminum hydroxide or aluminum glycinate. And so that's no good. And you have it in deodorants and douches. Yes, you can absorb it right through a douche. Food additives have aluminum. It's all over. Sodium aluminum phosphate is out there. And even shampoos, the anti-dandruff preparations, contain magnesium aluminum silicate and aluminum lauryl sulfate. So you're getting it all over the place. So what do you do? Well, you with me up to this point?
Right here.
Okay. Now what do we do? Well, we realize what we're really dealing with is an autotoxemia that has caused a local inflammatory process in the brain and all over the body, which has led to a lowered immune resistance, which has led to compounding allergic responses and progression of degeneration of disease. The disease is actually the symptom, not the cause. Are you clear on that?
Yes.
So we have to reverse the process.
Okay.
Begin with chelation therapy. Chelation therapy, chele, which is from the Greek, means claw-like. It takes the different compounds. And there's two types of chelating agents, one for mercury, one for other heavy metals like lead, cadmium, zinc. And you want to get both of those. And with Alzheimer's, you have to accelerate it. Generally, 3 to 4 days a week for about 50 to 100 treatments minimum. At the same time, you want to start to protect the neurons in the brain. So you're going to have to use neuron oxidative stimulants. Now, there are many. Acetylcholine, A-C-E-T-Y-L, that's acetyl. Choline, one word, C-H-O-L-I-N-E. And there I would go 700 milligrams three times a day on an empty stomach. That is one of the things you can do to help prevent dementia. So you know the memory shortages your mother's suffering from?
Yes.
The acetylcholine can help that.
All right.
All right. Then boron, B-O-R-O-N. 5 milligrams daily. That improves brain function. Most people think of boron for the bones. That's true. It is important in the mineralization of the bone, but it's also important for brain. Coenzyme Q10, 200 milligrams, three times a day. That increases oxygenation to cells and helps rejuvenate cellular energy, which is the mitochondria in the brain. Quite simply, the more energy the brain can produce in the form of its mitochondrial activity, the more antioxidants can help stop the free radical damage. It works this way. The more fatigued your brain is, the more free radicals are attacking it, the less repair your body's going to be able to go through. You simply cannot do with fatigue what you can do with energy. You need energy for healing. So you got to get your mother's energy back. You clear on this?
Yes. That was coenzyme Q10, 3 milligrams, three times a day?
300.
300, thank you.
Ginkgo, G-I-N-K-G-O, 100 milligrams twice a day. That increases microcirculation to the brain. It also increases microcirculation to the heart and the extremities, so it's going to help overall. Now, grape seed extract. Now, this comes as either pycnogenol, grape seed extract, or proanthocyanidins. And what it is, it's an active phytochemical antioxidant combination that can protect the brain, because it passes the blood-brain barrier, and protects the brain cells from free radical damage. Now, free radical damage is what really does a number. And you want to protect that. You could give your mother grape juice, fresh made, with organic grapes, which are in season. Or if not, if you can't get organic grapes, then get grapes that are not organic, but then spray it with the wash off, and then agitate it in either hydrogen peroxide or apple cider vinegar, and then rinse it, and that'll get about 99% of it off. And then juice the whole grape, skin, seed, the whole thing, twice a day. Selenium, 200 micrograms. It also protects the brain. B-complex, 50 milligrams twice a day. Zinc, 50 milligrams, because zinc helps stop amyloid plaque formation. Acetyl-L-carnitine, A-C-E-T-Y-L-L-carnitine, C-A-R-N-I-T-I-N-E, 500 milligrams three times a day. It removes toxins such as mercury, which contribute to dementia. Calcium, magnesium at 1,500 milligrams. Some citrate, that is important, acts as a natural calcium channel blocker. Melatonin at 3 milligrams improves brain function and immune system. Vitamin E at about 800 units helps to keep the oxygen that's in the brain moving, and it spaces the way that blood moves through the system without coagulating. It's a natural anticoagulant, which helps prevent strokes. Because one thing that people with Alzheimer's are susceptible to is blood sludging, clumping, and stroke. Butcher's broom. That's important. Lots of juices. The green chlorophyll juices are very important. No sugar, no refined carbohydrates, a good quality vegetarian diet, and then intravenous vitamins. Now, I don't have my protocols. I'm on the road, so I'm not carrying my protocols with me. But if you called, there is a physician who I gave my protocols to, because I can't counsel people when I'm out. He is over at the Metropolitan Wellness Center, and just call over there and say that you'd like to speak with someone concerning an Alzheimer's protocol, and then you'll get it. I don't want to give it over the air because of people assuming, oh, well, you know, that might be good for me, for what I have. No, these are very specific, and you have to, each protocol has to be specific to what a person needs, and these are not things you just play with.
All right.
A cancer protocol is different than an Alzheimer's, which is different than an arthritis protocol. Now, then there are also, there's another approach here. There is vitamin C, intravenous and also oral, buffered. And there's some medications. Now, that's the natural. That's 100% natural and non-toxic. I just gave you. Clear on that?
Yes.
But now I'm also going to suggest that you may have to give your mother some medications that do have some side effects, but minimal compared to what the orthodox model is.
Okay.
All right. And these would include hydrogen, H-Y-D-E-G-R-I-N-E, about 5 milligrams in the morning, 5 in the afternoon. Piracetam, P-I-R-A-C-E-T-A-M, about 1,500 milligrams in the morning, 1,500 in the afternoon. And it's really only possible benefit in early stages of the disease and only if cortisol levels are not elevated. And those two have been shown to make a difference. But again, those come under medical supervision and medical diagnosis. Also, you have to look at the type of estrogen level and glucose levels. Those two, you got to rebalance estrogen with natural estrogen replacement therapy. And you've also have to balance glucose, because almost always when the blood sugar shifts high or low, this can increase glycation, and that's a problem. You've got to get the omega-6 fatty acids that are found from your vegetables and your omega-3, which are found from perilla oil, linseed oil, or fish oil. And you also want to have oil of primrose. Now, magnets, including a magnetic headrest, magnetic mattress, magnetic seat cushion, any of these things that magnetize the body, especially the central nervous system and the brain, are very, very beneficial. When I travel, for instance, I travel with a magnet that helps me get a little bit of sleep and still have a lot of energy, and you have to consider that also. So those are some of the treatments that are out there that you should at least research, do your homework, get all your facts, and look on the internet, get as much information on each and every one of these as you can, so that when you sit down with a physician, you'll know what it is that you're suggesting. And you've got to cleanse that intestine out, and that's going to take a lot of fibers, of fruits and vegetables primarily, that are softer and easier. And you want to get the circulation really improved. The circulation is the key to everything. Hence, activity, physical activity, walking. Okay?
Yes, thanks a lot, Gary.
Okay.
Peace and blessings to you.
All the best.
Thank you.
I'm Gary Nall. Let's take another call. Your turn. You're on the air. Hi. What's your name?
Hi, Bill.
Hi, Bill.
Gary, I have a question, and while I know you don't really diagnose or treat disease, and I don't really need a diagnosis, I'm having a bit of a problem, and it's a specialized problem. I don't know if you can help me.
I'll try.
Recently, I had to have my aortic valve replaced because it was congenitally deformed, and it had calcified to the point where I could no longer function. And after the operation, everything's going well. I'm beginning to get my energy back. Everything's fine. But I have this persistent tachycardia, and the doctor at the time said, well, you were on the heart lung machine for a couple of hours and that destroys the blood. We'll be putting some extra iron in, and you've also, since we've had to do an invasive procedure, we've cut into the cardiac muscle itself, so that could cause some hypersensitivity. But it's gotten to the point where they keep having to, fool around with a pacemaker and fool around with drugs to see if they can pull the pulse rate down enough for me to exercise, for me to, come back to some semblance of normality. Now, doing some of my homework, I've been taking specialized vitamins for the heart, like coenzyme Q10 and L-carnitine fumarate and quercetin, and a lot of, as much as I can of the oral vitamin C. But I still am wondering whether or not I'm doing any I'm harming by taking this, by trying to stimulate an overstimulated organ or muscle, or whether or not I'm just trying to do something to pull it together. I'm trying to get oxygenation and trying to get some sort of healing going on, but I'm not sure where, you know, where I'm at, and I certainly don't want to. I'm rejecting my doctor's orders of trying to take a blood pressure drug to bring my pulse down because I don't have high blood pressure. I don't have any other medical problems.
Well, why would he want you to bring take a blood pressure medication?
Well, the tachycardia is such that right when I get into an area where I get to an aerobic, where I can benefit from aerobic exercise, my anaerobic limit is when the pacemaker starts counting out 2 to 1 instead of it's dropping my pulse rate from like 150 down to like 54, and mm-hmm. with a resultant drop in my blood pressure as well. I'm trying to, I'm walking around, I'm bicycling, I'm even going to go swimming today, but I'm not overdoing it because.
Okay, let me give you some input. All right.
Sure.
First, I would approach this a little differently. What I would do is I would get in touch with a physician who uses energy diagnosis. That is the only way to determine if the different things you're doing are beneficial or not. Energy diagnosis is known as energy medicine, and it's been around for a long time. It's just been kept under wraps because the average physician doesn't want to look like a screwball to all their colleagues. What it is, it's based upon the premise that the body knows what it needs and will tell you. All you have to do is ask it the right question. And I've seen it thousands of times. In the right hands, I advocate it. And it takes training to understand how it really works and how to interpret it. But I'll give you an idea. We took some people in a test to see from two groups of physicians. And without knowing anything about them whatsoever, or what their diagnosis was, or what their protocols were, based purely upon this method of energy evaluation, you ask the body certain questions. The body will respond, and it responds by sharing an energy, which can be measured, a strength or weakness energy, a kinesiological expression. And within under an hour, virtually everything that these people had was revealed and written down and then given to the actual physician. And it really was remarkable because the physician was just blown away. There's no way that anyone by looking at this person would have known what they had going on in their system. And yet it was not general. It was very specific. And it was correct. Most importantly was, are the medications or the treatment that would have been given by this physician working or not? And it showed that it was not working. And so it was able to determine which medications at which doses were most beneficial. And then a physician and scientist from Rome came in and wanted to test something. And I was the guinea pig. I was taking some intravenous vitamin C at the time, and I knew what level I could take, and it was very high level. And he used the same approach, but he did it with some new technology, and it showed that some of the things I was doing was the right amount. Others were wrong, and I should change the amount, and I did, and with a remarkable difference. And so, again, it's all in energy medicine. Now, this all sounds like mumbo-jumbo unless you've spent your life studying energy medicine and energy and healing process. So what you need to do is give a call to a physician who is specializing in energy diagnosis, a regular MD, board certified, but this is what they work with. They can then tell you whether or not what you're doing is right or not, or which nutrients, or which, you know, a magnet, or whether, you know, you're taking too much or too little, or should take it all, something. Otherwise, it's all guessing. To the larger question, can tachycardia be controlled or improved? The answer is yes. But each person is going to be a different approach. It's not one that you can make a general statement on. So to answer the larger question, yes, there is help, there is hope. And all you have to do is get into the hands of the right clinician who can guide you in your recovery process. Now, if you look at the clinicians in the back of Get Healthy Now, call them and ask each one under cardiology. So it's not a humongous list, so it won't take all that much time. Just ask them, do you do energy work? Do you do energy diagnosing or treating? If they say no, then thank them and go on to the next. There are several that do. Okay?
Thank you.
We have time for one more quick call. We'll take one more call. I'm Gary Nall. What's your name, please?
My name is Brian. Hi, Gary.
Hi, Brian.
Gary, a friend of mine recommended me. I'm a track runner. She told me that you run a lot of track also.
Yes, I do.
Yeah, I run. I'm going to run in Australia in the Goodwill Games. I run 5,000 meters and 10,000 meters.
Right.
I run like maybe 8 or 9 miles a night. I'm 45 years old. I'm running better than I did when I was 21, 22 years old.
Mm-hmm.
The next day I seem to like be a little a lack of energy, and when I don't work out, I get like kind of like anxiety. And I was taking valerian root. And I eat well. I eat a lot of chicken and turkey, and I eat salad a lot, and I drink a lot of juices. So my diet is pretty good. It could be a little better. You know, I eat pizza once in a while, but I know I shouldn't. But, you know, it's one of my pet peeves that
How old are you, Brian?
The last couple of years, I've been really trying to eat a lot better, and I eat a lot of fruits and vegetables also.
Okay, well, it goes a little bit beyond. How old are you?
I'm 45.
Okay, and you're training for the upcoming Goodwill Games, right?
Right. I'm going to run 5,000 meters and 10,000 meters.
Okay, well, running 5 and 10,000 meters, you're over-training. You're going further than what you should. You should be training at the distance that you're actually going to race. And you should be doing it on alternate days at full speed and recover on the in-between days. It seems like you're doing far more than what you should,
right,
and you're doing it harder than what you should. So you're not giving the body a chance to recover. So your chi is down, and then your immune system will follow that. At the rate you're going to burn out your chi. And what you want to do is conserve the chi, because the chi is what you really use in those races.
Right.
So I would suggest you change your training schedule. I also suggest that you start loading your body up with the recovery anabolic nutrients. The nutrients like the coenzyme Q10, vitamin E, and L-carnitine, and L-cysteine, and L-methionine, and calcium, magnesium, and glutathione. Before you work out,
okay,
and then afterwards, complete vegetable protein, which will help the body to not break down its muscle mass. And otherwise, you're going to be breaking down your muscle mass, catabolizing your immune system, and in time, you're going to burn out. So bring back the mileage. You're going too over your what you should as your ideal for the distance you're doing. Okay, we're out of time. I want to thank you very much and all the people for listening today. I'm Gary Nall, and I'll be recording on my Sunday night show. I'm going to try to give a live broadcast from Cuba. I don't know if we'll be able to get the hookup between now and then, and otherwise I'll hopefully have it by next week. In any case, have a good day. I'll see you back here tomorrow.